My name is Michael McCusker. As most of you probably know, the month of March is Women's History Month in the United States. And tomorrow, March 8th, is International Women's Day. And this year, 2013, is the 50th anniversary of The Feminine Mystique, written by Betty Friedan, which was published in February 1963. And I'd like to read a couple of things written about The Feminine Mystique and its consequences, you might say. And the first is by Gail Collins, and it's excerpted from the introduction to the 50th anniversary edition of The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, which was published last month by W.W. Norton and Company. And Gail Collins is a writer for the New York Times. Every writer yearns to create a book that will seize the moment, to perfectly encapsulate the problem of an era before other people even notice the problem exists. Of course, that almost never happens. Mostly, we're happy if we can manage to explain in an interesting way something people already know is going on. But Betty Friedan won the gold ring. When The Feminine Mystique emerged in 1963, it created a reaction so intense that Friedan could later write another book about the things women said to her about the first one. And that book was It Changed My Life. If there's a list of the most important books of the 20th century, The Feminine Mystique is on it. It also made one conservative magazine's exclusive roundup of the 10 most harmful books of the 19th and 20th centuries, which, if not flattering, is at least a testimony to the wallop it packed. We are still reading it today. In A Strange Stirring, her book about the feminine mystique and its impact, Stephanie Kuntz writes that her students responded viscerally to chapters like The Sexual Cell that spoke to their own feelings of being under pressure to buy consumer goods and to present themselves as objects to be consumed. And of course, if you want to understand what has happened to American women over the last half century, their extraordinary journey from Doris Day to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and beyond, you have to start with this book. Critics and many fans feel obliged to point out the things that The Feminine Mystique ignores, and they are right to be a bit flummoxed, though although Friedan was writing during the Civil Rights Movement, she barely mentions African-American women. Working-class women make their appearance mainly in a few suggestions that married women who want to work might want to hire a housekeeper or a nanny. Remarkably, Friedan managed to write a whole book indicting American society for its attitudes towards women without discussing its laws. In 1963, most women weren't able to get credit without a male cosigner. In some states, they couldn't sit on juries. In others, their husbands had control not only of their property, but also of their earnings. Although Friedan obsesses about women getting jobs, she does not mention that newspapers were allowed to divide their help-wanted ads into categories for men and women, or that it was perfectly legal for an employer to announce that certain jobs were for men only. Even the federal government did it. In a strange way, all those deficits are the book's strength. The Feminine Mystique is a very specific cry of rage about the way intelligent, well-educated women were kept out of the mainstream of American professional life and regarded as little more than a set of reproductive organs in heels. It is supremely, specifically personal, and that's what gives it such gut-punching power. Friedan dropped out of her postgraduate studies because, she said, her academic success was threatening to her boyfriend. She was furious about the way the female college students of the next generation had been programmed to regard getting an MRS degree, which is Mrs., as the be-all and end-all of their experience in higher education. She was enraged by the way the psychiatric profession regarded housewives' unhappiness as a symptom of an out-of-whack libido. She was angry at the way the economy appeared to see her entire sex as simple consumption machines who built national prosperity by buying new appliances for the kitchen and searching madly for the perfect laundry detergent. And don't get her started on women's magazines. Frieden wrote for them, and she piles up one astonishingly awful example of the selling of the feminine mystique after another. There's one short story about a young woman who planned to be something, then married, wore out 6 copies of Dr. Spock's childcare book, and wound up declaiming, "I'm lucky, I'm lucky, I'm so glad to be a woman." And that last sentence was all in caps with exclamation marks. You really can envision the team from the mental hospital strapping her to a gurney. The post-war suburbs were either heaven or hell for their inhabitants. Endless stretches of brand new houses on quarter-acre lots, occupied during weekday hours entirely by women and children. I grew up in one in Cincinnati, where the dads drove off to work every morning and went in what was then the only family car, leaving behind a land in which the only adult males were Tommy the milkman and Art, who drove an old bus outfitted with shelves of groceries that he sold to the stranded housewives. I grew up in a place just like that at that time. We had the green bus that came every Monday. The moms were busy, mainly with the several small kids, but they were not overworked. The high point of the day came at 4 or 5 when the chores were done, dinner was in the oven, and the women could congregate in someone's kitchen or on the back porch to drink and talk. In our house, at least, that was followed by my father's arrival and a second cocktail hour, during which my parents discussed their day with the older children, while the older children took the younger ones for endless walks in the stroller. Perhaps the only way Frieden's household resembled mine was in the drinking. In the feminine mystique, Frieden tried to portray herself as the typical middle-class housewife of the early 60s. But really, the Smith graduate who worked for a series of left-wing and union newspapers in Manhattan before matrimony and motherhood was no such thing. She was from a smaller cadre of women who went to college holding 2 self-images simultaneously, the future stay-at-home housewife and the serious student who cared about grades and reading lists and serious discussions, who took the same courses as the men, or who, like Frieden, went to Smith and presumed her courses were actually harder. Then she was off to graduate school until the boy she was dating took her for a walk in the Berkeley Hills and said, "Nothing can come of this between us because I'll never win a fellowship like yours." Frieden gave up her academic career, came east, and lived in the present, working on newspapers with no particular plan. I married, had children, lived according to the feminine mystique as a suburban housewife. And that's a quote from Frieden, of course. Did that really happen? Did that one remark from a jealous suitor really send Frieden off to New York and marriage to an entirely different man? It doesn't actually matter. What matters is that as a housewife, even one who kept writing freelance magazine articles on the side, Frieden was bored out of her mind. The difference between her era and the past, she understood, was that the nature of housework had changed when Americans moved from the farm to the cities and then the suburbs. The farm wife had a crucial economic role in the family, which depended on her to manufacture the clothes, the soap, the candles, and the cheese, to grow the vegetables and raise the chickens, and to participate in the informal housewife economy where she could trade the things she made for other vital family supplies. The suburban housewife had no economic point at all, and modern appliances had stripped her of most of the time-consuming chores of the past as well. A woman's sense of self, Frieden wrote, quote, once rested on necessary work and achievement in the home. But that vanished in an era when housework is no longer really necessary or really uses much ability in a country and at a time when women can be free, finally, to move on to something more. Frieden's analysis of what was bothering her turned into the feminine mystique. And when it hit the stands, women who were feeling bored and trapped by their perfect homes and marriages picked up the book and mentally repositioned themselves in the world. Some of the women were outraged that the feminine mystique placed their choices into question, and others, like myself, felt at last they had been understood, said Madeline Coonan, who argued about it at her book club in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she was the wife of a medical student. Coonan later rejoined the working world herself. Like Frieden, she overachieved, and eventually she became governor of Vermont. As far as I know, none of the moms in my neighborhood read the feminine mystique. If they ever questioned their choices, it was later, when an inherent flaw became apparent in the ideal suburban lifestyle that was celebrated in all those women's magazines that drove Frieden nuts. The feminine mystique was built around the central feminine role as mother. But the first generation of suburbanites had their babies young, and the children were grown and gone while their role-deprived moms were still in the prime of their lives. We looked back from our new homes at college dorms and understood that this was an emptiness we had to protect ourselves against. Later, when we got our late-arriving hands on the feminine mystique, it was an aha moment. Frieden's obsession about having a career, the one answer she seemed to grab for at every single problem, made perfect sense. The feminine mystique became the kind of bestseller that defines an author's life. In 1966, Frieden was researching another book in Washington when she wound up at a conference of state commissions on the status of women, where attendees were angry over the fact that the federal government had made it clear it had no intention of enforcing a law against job discrimination on the basis of sex that was included in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. This is a good time to point out that the feminine mystique did not create the women's rights movement. Those commissions on the status of women were started by the Kennedy administration before the book was published and the Civil Rights Act was being debated in Congress, while American housewives were still just starting to pass around Frieden's book. It was in Frieden's hotel room that the angry conference goers met to discuss what they should do when the Johnson administration showed no interest in pursuing the issue. Frieden was universally known as a difficult personality, and at one point she locked herself in the bathroom and told everyone to go home, but no one did. The next day, it was Frieden's coterie that angrily passed around notes at lunch, creating, on the spot, the National Organization for Women, which Frieden would head. It would be now, under Frieden, that would file suits on behalf of exactly the kind of average, unglamorous, working women that the feminine mystique is always criticized for ignoring. And in 1970, it was Frieden who called for the Great March to celebrate the 50th anniversary of women's suffrage, creating a mass turnout in cities around the country that would drive home to the nation exactly how determined women were to transform their lives and their society. In New York, the marchers were denied a parade permit for Fifth Avenue, and were told to keep to the sidewalks. Frieden, at the head of the pack, took the lead again. "There was no way we were about to walk down Fifth Avenue in a little thin line," she wrote later. "I waved my arms over my head and yelled, 'Take to the streets!'" What a moment that was. And that was... The last was a quote by Betty Friedman, and Gail Collins wrote what I just read, and it's excerpted from the 50th anniversary edition of The Feminine Mystique, her introduction to Betty Friedan's book, which was published last month, the 50th anniversary of The Feminine Mystique. And now I'm going to read a story from the New York Times by Stephanie Kuntz, who was quoted in this last article, and it's a pretty dense article, and I might have to jump over a few things. But it's called Why Gender Equality Stalled. Betty Friedan's book led to profound attitudinal changes, but our system still favors old stereotypes, by Stephanie Kuntz. This year is the 50th anniversary of the publication of Betty Friedan's international bestseller, The Feminine Mystique, which has been widely credited with igniting the women's movement of the 1960s. Readers who return to this feminist classic today are often puzzled by the absence of concrete political proposals to change the status of women. But the feminine mystique had the impact it did because it focused on transforming women's personal consciousness. In 1963, most Americans did not yet believe that gender equality was possible or even desirable. Conventional wisdom held that a woman could not pursue a career and still be a fulfilled wife or successful mother. Normal women, psychiatrists proclaimed, renounced all aspirations outside the home to meet their feminine need for dependence. In 1962, more than two-thirds of the women surveyed by the University of Michigan researchers agreed that most important family decisions, quote, should be made by the man of the house, unquote. It was in this context that Friedan set out to transform the attitudes of women, arguing that, quote, the personal is political, unquote. Feminists urged women to challenge the assumption at work and at home that women should always be the ones who make the coffee, watch over the children, pick up after men, and serve the meals. Over the next 30 years, this emphasis on equalizing gender roles at home as well as at work produced a revolutionary transformation in Americans' attitudes. It was not instant. As late as 1977, two-thirds of Americans believed that it was much better for everyone involved if the man is the achiever outside the home and the woman takes care of the home and family, quote unquote. By 1994, two-thirds of Americans rejected this notion. But during the second half of the 1990s and the first few years of the 2000s, the equality revolution seemed to stall. Between 1994 and 2004, the percentage of Americans preferring the male breadwinner, female homemaker family model actually rose to 40% from 34%. Between 1997 and 2007, the number of full-time working mothers who said they would prefer to work part-time increased to 60% from 48%. In 1997, a quarter of stay-at-home mothers said full-time work would be ideal. By 2007, only 16% of stay-at-home mothers wanted to work full-time. Women's labor force participation in the United States also leveled off in the second half of the 1990s, in contrast to its continued increase in most other countries. Gender desegregation of college majors and occupations slowed. And although single mothers continued to increase their hours of paid labor, there was a significant jump in the percentage of married women, especially married women with infants, who left the labor force. By 2004, a smaller percentage of married women with children under three were in the labor force than in 1993. Some people began to argue that feminism was not about furthering the equal involvement of men and women at home and work, but simply about giving women the right to choose between pursuing a career and devoting themselves to full-time motherhood. A new emphasis on intensive mothering and attachment parenting helped justify the latter choice. Anti-feminists welcomed this shift as a sign that most Americans did not want to push gender equality too far, and feminists worried that they were seeing a resurgence of traditional gender roles and beliefs, embarked on a new round of consciousness raising. Books with titles like The Feminine Mistake and Get to Work warned of the stiff penalties women paid for dropping out of the labor force, even for relatively brief periods. Cultural critics questioned the perfect madness, and that's a quote, of intensifying mothering and helicopter parenting, noting the problems that resulted when, as Ms. Friedan had remarked about housewifery, mothering expands to fill the time available. One study cautioned that nearly 30% of opt-out moms who wanted to rejoin the labor force were unable to do so, and of those who did return, only 40% landed full-time professional jobs. In The Price of Motherhood, the journalist Ann Crittenden estimated that the typical college-educated woman lost more than $1 million in lifetime earnings and foregone retirement benefits before she opted out. Other feminists worried that the equation of feminism with an individual woman's choice to opt out of the workforce undermined the movement's commitment to a larger vision of gender equity and justice. Joan Williams, the founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law, argued that defining feminism as giving mothers the choice to stay home assumes that their partners have the responsibility to support them and thus denies choice to fathers. The political theorist Lori Marceau noted that emphasizing personal choice ignores the millions of women without a partner who can support them. These are all important points, but they can sound pretty abstract to men and women who are stuck between a rock and a hard place when it comes to arranging their work and family lives. For more than two decades, the demands and hours of work have been intensifying. Yet progress in adopting family-friendly work practices and social policies has proceeded at a glacial pace. Today, the main barriers to further progress toward gender equity no longer lie in people's personal attitudes and relationships. Instead, structural impediments prevent people from acting on their egalitarian values, forcing men and women into personal accommodations and rationalizations that do not reflect their preferences. The gender revolution is not in a stall. It has hit a wall. In today's political climate, it is startling to remember that 80 years ago, in 1933, the Senate overwhelmingly voted to establish a 30-hour work week. The bill failed in the House, but 5 years later, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 gave Americans a statutory 40-hour work week. By the 1960s, American workers spent less time on the job than their counterparts in Europe and Japan. Between 1990 and 2000, however, average annual work hours for employed Americans increased. By 2000, the United States had outstripped Japan, the former leader of the work pack, in the hours devoted to paid work. Today, almost 40% of men in professional jobs work 50 or more hours a week, as do almost a quarter of men in middle-income occupations. Individuals in lower-income and less skilled jobs work fewer hours, but they are more likely to experience frequent changes in shifts, mandatory overtime on short notice, and non-standard hours. And many low-income workers are forced to work two jobs to get by. When we look at dual-earner couples, the workload becomes even more daunting. As of 2000, the average dual-earner couple worked a combined 82 hours a week, while almost 15% of married couples had a joint work week of 100 hours or more. Astonishingly, despite the increased workload of families, and even though 70% of American children now live in households where every adult in the home is employed, in the past 20 years, the United States has not passed any major federal initiative to help workers accommodate their family and work demands. The Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993 guaranteed covered workers up to 12 weeks unpaid leave after a child's birth or adoption, or in the case of a family illness. Although only about half the total workforce was eligible, it seemed a promising start. But aside from the belated requirement of the new Affordable Care Act that nursing mothers be given a private space at work to pump breast milk, the FMLA turned out to be the inadequate end. Meanwhile, since 1990, other nations with comparable resources have implemented a comprehensive agenda of work-family reconciliation acts. As a result, when the United States work-family policies are compared with those of countries at similar levels of economic and political development, the United States comes in dead last. When people are caught between the hard place of bad working conditions and the rock wall of politicians' resistance to family-friendly reforms, it is hard to live up to such aspirations. The Boston College study found that only 30%, I should say a Boston College study, found that only 30% of the fathers who wanted to share child care equally with their wives actually did so, a gap that helps explain why American men today report higher levels of work-family conflict than women. Under the circumstances, how likely is it that the young adult surveyed by Pew will meet their goal of sharing breadwinning and caregiving? The answer is suggested by the finding of the New York University sociologist Kathleen Gerson in interviews she did for her 2010 book, The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family. 80% of the women and 70% of the men Ms. Gerson interviewed said they wanted an egalitarian relationship that allowed them to share breadwinning and family care. But when asked what they would do if this was not possible, they described a variety of fallback positions. While most of the women wanted to continue paid employment, the majority of men said that if they could not achieve their egalitarian ideal, they expected their partner to assume primary responsibility for parenting so they could focus on work. And that is how it usually works out. When family and work obligations collide, mothers remain much more likely than fathers to cut back or drop out of work. But unlike the situation in the 1960s, this is not because most people believe this is the preferable order of things. Rather, it is often a reasonable response to the fact that our political and economic institutions lag way behind our personal ideals. Women are still paid less than men at every educational level and in every job category. They are less likely than men to hold jobs that offer flexibility or family-friendly benefits. When they become mothers, they face more scrutiny and prejudice on the job than fathers do. So, especially when women are married to men who work long hours, it often seems to both partners that they have no choice. Female professionals are twice as likely to quit work as other married mothers when their husbands work 50 hours or more a week, and more than three times more likely to quit when their husbands work 60 hours or more. The sociologist Pamela Stone studied a group of mothers who had made these decisions. Typically, she found, they phrased their decision in terms of a preference. But when they explained their decision-making process, it became clear that most had made the choice to quit work only as a last resort, when they could not get the flexible hours or part-time work they wanted, when their husbands would not or could not cut back their hours, and when they began to feel that their employers were hostile to their concerns. Under those conditions, Professor Stone notes, what was really a workplace problem for families became a private problem for women. This is where the political gets really personal. When people are forced to behave in ways that contradict their ideals, they often undergo what sociologists call a value stretch, watering down their original expectations and goals to accommodate the things they have to do to get by. This behavior is especially likely if holding on to the original values would exacerbate tensions in the relationships they depend on. In their years of helping couples make the transition from partners to parents, the psychologists Philip and Carolyn Cowan have found that tensions increase when a couple backslide into more traditional roles than they originally desired. The woman resents that she is not getting the shared child care she expected, and envies her husband's social networks outside the home. The husband feels hurt that his wife isn't more grateful for the sacrifices he is making by working more hours so she can stay home. When you can't change what's bothering you, one typical response is to convince yourself that it doesn't actually bother you. So couples often create a family myth about why they made these choices, why it has turned out for the best, and why they are still equal in their hearts, even if they are not sharing the kind of life they first envisioned. Under present conditions, the intense consciousness raising about the rightness of personal choices that worked so well in the early days of the women's movement will end up escalating the divisive finger-pointing that stands in the way of political reform. Our goal should be to develop work-life policies that enable people to put their gender values into practice. So let's stop arguing about the hard choices women make and help more women and men avoid such hard choices. To do that, we must stop seeing work-family policy as a women's issue and start seeing it as a human rights issue that affects parents, children, partners, singles, and elders. Feminists should certainly support this campaign, but they don't need to own it. And that was Gender Equality by Stephanie Kuntz. The full article is Why Gender Equality Stalled. And Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of family history at Evergreen State College. You know where that is, just a few miles across the river. And the author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. And what I first read, pardon all the crinkling of newsprint, but that's one of my favorite sounds. My second favorite is the popping of a cork out from a wine bottle. The first one was by Gail Collins, and actually she wrote this for the New York Times. Well, she wrote it for the as an introduction to the 50th anniversary edition of The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, but it was excerpted for the January 27th, 2013 New York Times Sunday Magazine. So we're up to our ears in New York Times stuff today, I guess. But this is the first week of Women's History Month here in the USA. And tomorrow is International Women's Day. And tomorrow, March 8th, also starts the 30th anniversary pledge drive for KMUN, which will run from tomorrow through the next Monday. Not the coming Monday, but the next Monday. And I don't know the date of that. I should. And also, Saturday is the beginning, or when we should first sight, a new comet in the sky. So look towards the west around sunset, and we will have a new comet. And it should last straight through April. And next week, if I'm still around and one of those drones doesn't incinerate me or I fall into the river, I'd like to read something about the previous comet that appeared in our sky these same months of March and April in 1996, Comet Kahutaki, something, a journal I kept. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.